the lightning flashing. Oh, yeah.
The singer Wilson Pickett got his start singing gospel in Detroit in the 1950s. He is one of the singers here in a gospel group called the Violinaires. But like a lot of gospel singers in the 1950s and early 60s, Pickett decided to strike out for another kind of glory, the fame and fortune of pop music. And he also came out as a sinner. He was nicknamed Wicked Pickett for his brushes with the law and his behavior with women. Pickett's commercial breakthrough came with a song he released in 1965 at age 24. And our story of that song begins with somebody who worked with him, Dan Aykroyd.
You know, Wilson Pickett was just briefly in the Blues Brothers 2000. I was Al Wood and he was Wilson Pickett.
Just what is it that you do exactly?
I'm 18 years old. I'm blonde, 36, 24, 36, and my name is Bambi.
And he was great to work with, and he was appreciative of the focus, you know. But what you got with the Wicked Pickett was an edge in music that many of the other artists of the time did not have. Kind of a dangerous edge, unpredictable, and occasionally bearing weapons.
Wilson was what I would call a natural shouter. He had that foot-stomping Baptist church shouting voice that, in his case, he could shout and scream in tune.
Oh, 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 I need your good loving, baby.
I'm Tony Fletcher. I'm an author, and I wrote the biography In the Midnight Hour, The Life and Soul of Wilson Pickett. Wilson Pickett was born and raised in Prattville, Alabama. Wilson realized very early on that he'd been given a gift with his voice and that he wanted to take that gift as far as he could take it. This is a guy who had some big R&B hits, first with the Falcons, writing and singing I Found a Love, which to me is a seminal moment when gospel and vocal group R&B helps give birth to soul music.
I love the Falcons, but I'm going on my own. So Sir Mac Ryan said, that's exactly what you're going to be, is on your own. Don't forget what we found you. You're going to be on your own. You ain't going to do nothing. I said, well, I got to see that for myself, you know.
He had then signed to Atlantic Records, who had really kind of misjudged where he sat in the market. They were not the right people to be writing for Wilson Pickett. He really needed to be in with really R&B musicians, and he probably needed to be back down south. I think both Wilson and Jerry Wexler, who was his point person at Atlantic, both were of the same mind for different reasons, that what would make sense for Wilson Pickett would be to see if they could get him in at the Stax Studios down in Memphis. Stax was based in an old cinema. It had its studio there on the sloping floor of the cinema. It had a record shop out front in the old candy store. And it was run by a brother and sister, two older white people, Jim Stewart and his sister Estelle Axton. And they had really kind of lucked into and found an affinity with R&B music. And what was really unique is that it was integrated at a time that Memphis was anything but integrated. So that was very, very unusual. And Stax, as a result, starting to develop a sound, a very, very southern soul sound. Its star performer was Otis Redding.
These arms are mine. They are lonely.
And Wilson's reason for wanting to record at Stax was because he heard Otis Redding's These Arms of Mine and said, I want to go where that record was recorded. That's where I belong.
Hi there, this is Steve Cropper.
Steve Cropper was the sort of de facto producer for all the sessions at Stax, but he was also a part of the backing band in the studio that backed Otis Redding, that backed Sam and Dave, that backed Eddie Floyd, Wilson Pickett, Carla Thomas, all the way through.
Jerry Wexler had called Jim Stewart, who was the president of Stax, and told Jim, we've got this artist we want to bring down and have you record. I didn't know Wilson Pickett at the time. But I worked in a record shop, so we started looking for things that he might have sung on, and somewhere somebody came up with a gospel record. I remember playing the fade out over and over because he'd go into this chant about, I'm going to wait till the midnight hour, I'm going to see my Jesus in the midnight hour, whoa, in the midnight hour.
Wilson didn't just come up with the idea of singing about in the midnight hour. The phrase the midnight hour had been around in gospel music. It was a very, very common phrase.
Jim and I pick up Jerry and Wilson at the airport in Memphis. Go to the hotel, which was that time a Holiday Inn, it's not there anymore, at the corner of Poplar Avenue and Crosstown. And Jerry said, Jim and I are going to go eat something and have a meeting. You guys go ahead and get started writing.
When I went down to Memphis, I took four or five hit songs down there that I had written. Steve Cropper was a very together guy. Like he would pitch in, he would jump in there. If something he changed or something he'd doing this way or that way, then he was good at doing that. So he'd come to my hotel, we put everything there together, make it right.
And about, I don't know, about 2 hours later or so, knock on the door, opened it, and Jerry says, how's it going? So we played him two songs. And he said, man, I'm getting out of here. You guys are doing well. He said, just keep writing.
They went in the next day and recorded these four songs, and one of them, of course, was In the Midnight Hour.
The midnight hour, I guess, is when a man and a woman are in a room together and it's time to decide whether there's going to be some kind of a consensual interaction.
To me, essentially, it's a moment of loving. I mean, it's really like that dark hour of the night.
Wilson, actually, what happens at the midnight hour? What actually goes on once the clock strikes 12?
All sorts of things. You had to get up and take the dog out. I mean, anything could happen.
You hear Donald Duck Dunn with the most obvious of bass lines. It's really just an arpeggio on the two chords that run through the verse. Yet something in the way that he plays it has made it one of the most idealized bass lines that you would ever come across. Over the top of Donald Duck Dunn's wonderful arpeggio and with the brass dancing all around it, is Al Jackson on drums and Steve Cropper really coming down together on that two and the four.
Jerry Wexler was the acting producer because he had brought Wilson down. And he didn't like what I was playing and he said, Steve, can you just play straight backbeats?
Steve would have had every right to say, Mr. Wexler, you know, we're the guys making hits here. You haven't delivered a hit for Wilson Pickett. We know what we're doing. Could you kindly leave us alone and we'll get on with what we're doing? But Steve did not say that. He listened to Jerry.
Some people out there might not know what a backbeat is, and that's usually what the drummer plays. And he usually puts it in R&B on two and four. One, two, accent, three, then four. Very heavy. The accent on two and four keeps everybody's little booty moving, and that's what we always did.
Which apparently was influenced by a big dance at the time and a number one hit called The Jerk.
You have seen it performed right here on Hollywood A Go-Go. Let me give you a few simple basic facts. All you have to do is take the bump, 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 beat. Let's see,
was it? And it was like a pull down, put your hands or fists up in the air and kind of pull down towards your belt line. And if you do that on two and four, then that's called The Jerk.
To emphasize the point, apparently, Jerry came out of the control room. This is a guy who was already well into middle age. And so it's like their dad coming out of the control room. And he starts demonstrating the jerk in the studio, looking a little bit like a sort of out of shape middle-aged boxer in the process.
We were in a big studio, very big studio, And we didn't do anything in those days with headphones. They might have been invented, but we didn't use them. I learned to stay right with the drummer by watching his left hand.
Back in those days, this was being recorded all in one go, all in one take, live to tape. The brass section did not come in afterwards. You know, there's no overdubs to this. This is the recording, the one take recording. And so you've got to imagine eight musicians plus Wilson Pickett in a room with a sloping studio recording live to two track.
The horns are vital to these tracks. They produce this fullness and this breadth and width in the music that was kind of missing in rock and roll.
They play in a way that manages to sound at once both sort of laid back and incredibly urgent at the same time. The brass comes in as if it's almost an afterthought, and yet the more that you listen to that brass, the more you realize it suits the song. And obviously, Wilson Pickett's performance is absolutely stellar. That recording helped soul music explode in a way that it hadn't previously. Otis Redding had certainly not crossed over to a white audience like this while remaining 100% credible with your core black audience. It was popular in the South. It was popular in the North. It was popular all across Europe. It was a record that transcended race. It was a record that transcended genre. And it's a record that you could take into a college classroom and say, this is a textbook case of songwriting, performance, and production. And as such, I think it stands up as one of the great American recordings.
What struck me about seeing him and hearing him was just the full-on commitment, the vibrancy and the edge and the danger in his performance, you know, and that wonderful voice he had, just at the top of his capabilities, and he always pushed it and never held back at all.
It was so big that you would go out and hear a house band at some club somewhere, and they would always have that song playing.
To this day, you could walk into a bar, probably in most cities in America tonight, and maybe even across the world, and a band somewhere is covering In the Midnight Hour. You can't speak much more for a song's longevity than that.
And in fact, the cover you're hearing now is a five-piece English wedding band called Inner Vision. Charlene Leverton on lead vocals playing at, yes, an actual wedding in the county of Wiltshire. Congratulations, Becky and Dan. Our story was produced by Jenny Cataldo and BMP Audio. Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour was recently chosen by the Library of Congress to be part of the National Recording Registry. The clips of him you heard were from a 1995 interview conducted by Dan Aykroyd for the House of Blues Radio Hour. Wilson Pickett died in 2006.